first time in our Reagan oral history series that we're able to welcome a University of Virginia PhD to participation in the program. So that's an accomplishment. This is also a banner week for the Miller Center since the chief of protocol, Mrs. Roosevelt, is coming on Friday. So we'll have a good chance to learn more about the Reagan presidency from two different perspectives. John Michael Albertine is vice chairman and director of Farley Industries, a company which, following its merger with Northwest Industries, achieved a record of $2 billion in sales in its program. He's also vice president of the Institute for Research on the Economics of Taxation in Washington. He was born in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. His father was a coal miner. He was educated at King's College, Wilkesboro, Pennsylvania, receiving a Bachelor's of Science degree in Economics, magna cum laude. He received his doctorate in economics at the University of Virginia in 1975. Then he taught and was chairman of economics at Mary Washington College. And in the mid to late 70s was legislative assistant to Senator Lloyd Benson and then executive director of the Congressional Joint Economic Committee. Following that, from 1980 to 1986, he was president of the American Business Conference, a coalition of 100 mid-sized, fast-growing companies. In the 1980s, he was also the chairman of the Deficit Reduction Action Group and also the Coalition to Reduce High Effective Tax Rates. The New York Times, at the time of some of these activities, described him as a respected supply-side economist and a tenacious lobbyist who has powerful backers on Capitol Hill in the ear of the Reagan administration. They also had this sentence in a report on him: he's a Washington insider who knows how to play the game well. So for all these reasons, we're very pleased that Mr. Albertine is with us. He's coming home, and he has a perspective on the Reagan presidency that we may not have heard in our discussions thus far.
Thank you very much, Ken. I deeply appreciate the opportunity to be at the Miller Center. It's the first time I've been here. It's quite grand and wonderful, and it's always spectacularly wonderful to be back in Charlottesville at the university, and it's particularly good to be here on a non-football weekend. I am on the board and executive committee of a company called Fruit of the Loom, which is one of the nation's foremost maker of men's and boys', women's and girls' underwear and activewear. And I have pledged to my lovely wife that I would not tell any underwear jokes today. But I want you all to know that as you leave, there's going to be an inspection out here to make sure everybody's wearing their Fruit of the Looms. As Ken said, let me just perhaps give you a little background about what I was doing in Washington between the 1981 and 1986, when I was in Washington on a full-time basis, and how that relates to the Reagan administration. The story starts in late 1980. I was the staff director of the Joint Economic Committee of the Congress. The Joint Economic Committee of the Congress was the committee which was established by the Employment Act of 1946. The Employment Act of 1946 was really the imprimatur of the final really imprimatur of the Keynesian revolution on the federal government. The Employment Act of 1946 pledged the federal government to maintain full employment and price stability, which is two wonderful goals. And basically, through the idea was government intervention in the economy. And to sort of monitor from a congressional point of view that activity, it established the Congressional Joint Economic Committee. And from 1946 until 1979, when Senator Benson of Texas became chairman of the committee and I became the staff director, I think it's fair to say, except for a brief period when Senator Taft was chairman, that the Joint Economic Committee was probably in the forefront of Keynesian economics on Capitol Hill, probably more stronger with respect to government intervention than any other single committee in the Congress. When we took over the Joint Economic Committee in 1979, Senator Benson and I decided that we thought that that was really not the approach that the committee ought to take with respect to recommending economic policy for the Congress. And so we set out to try to bring the committee together, all the Democrats and Republicans on the committee. And the committee went from Senator, sort of reasonable liberals like Senator Kennedy and Senator Proxmire and Congressman Royce and Senator McGovern, all the way over to Bill Roth, Senator Roth from Delaware, and Congressman Ruslo from California, who was a member of the John Birch Society at one point. So he had a wide range of views. We set out to try to unite the committee around an economic program which we thought made sense for the 80s. And the program which the Joint Economic Committee recommended to the Congress in 1979 and 1980 involved the following elements. It involved cutting the rate of growth of federal spending, cutting taxes, particularly marginal tax rates, and particularly on the corporate side, depreciation reform, 10-5-3 in those days and that sort of thing. Reduction in the rate of growth of the monetary aggregates to fight inflation, decontrol of oil prices and natural gas, and an attempt to try to get a command over resources exercised by the federal government through the regulatory apparatus. That was the program of the Joint Economic Committee. Now, that program, I think, might sound fairly familiar because it was pretty much along the lines of the program that the governor of California was outlining in his campaign for president. I left the Joint Economic Committee in 1981, in early 1981, actually late 1980, to become president of an organization called the American Business Conference, which was an organization put together by Arthur Levitt, who was chairman of the American Stock Exchange. And the purpose of the group was to somehow put together a group of chief executive officers of mid-size growth companies, sort of a counterweight to the Business Roundtable, which is an organization in Washington of the CEOs of the top 200 corporations in America. And the idea was that these companies would be firms that not only were mid-size but had high growth, at least grew at 15% a year, so they doubled in size every 5 years. Arthur Levitt was putting that organization together. He asked me to become president of it, and we launched the organization in early 1981. Now, when we launched the organization, there are two issues here which are rather important. One is I had developed a little bit of a reputation in Washington for being a supply-side economist. The Joint Economic Committee reports had gotten an awful lot of attention from the media, and most importantly, the Wall Street Journal, which wrote editorial after editorial about the good work the Joint Economic Committee was doing and the bad work the Budget Committee and other committees of the Congress were doing. And so I had developed a relationship with a number of people who were to become relatively key players in the first Reagan administration. Norman Touré, who is a supply-side economist, who was undersecretary of the Treasury for Economic Affairs. Paul Craig Roberts, who's another PhD from the University of Virginia, who was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy, and a host of other people. So the combination of having done a lot of work on supply-side economics and chairing a group of entrepreneurs at a time in 1981 when the general perception in Washington was of an American economy in inevitable and fundamental decline meant that we developed a very, very close and good working relationship with the Reagan White House, really almost from the beginning in 1981. We were very active with the administration, with the trio who ran the White House, Deaver, Meese, and Baker, in the early days of the administration on the issue of the 1981 tax reduction. And let me just go back for a moment and talk about our how we developed those relationships, quite apart from me. One of the early members of the American Business Conference was a man named Bob Mosbacher, who was one of our vice chairmen. Bob, of course, is currently the Secretary of Commerce. Bob had been the finance director for George Bush in 1976 and the finance director for George Bush's presidential campaign in 1980, and then became co-finance director of the Reagan campaign in 1980. And obviously he was very, very close to the vice president at that time, George Bush, and very close to Jim Baker, who was George Bush's campaign manager and then became Reagan's campaign manager. So through Bob Mosbacher, we got to know and have a very close working relationship with Jim Baker. And Jim Baker was chief of staff of the White House, and so that was a very important relationship. And then secondly, one of the early members of the American Business Conference is a man named Gordon Luce, who runs a, who's the CEO, chairman and CEO of a San Diego-based savings and loan called Great Western. It turns out that Gordon Luce had a little bit of a political career. Namely, he was a chairman of the Republican Party in California and was appointed to that post in 1967 by then the then governor of California, Ronald Reagan. And he had a very close relationship with the president and a very close relationship with Ed Meese. So as a result of those two relationships, we got to know Jim Baker very well. We got to know Ed Meese very well. They got to learn a little bit about our background, a little bit about our organization. The administration came in as administration which was really focused on our kinds of companies. We're really interested in entrepreneurship. We're less interested in sort of the business roundtable kind of folks. And as a result, we had a good working relationship and participated early on in the fight for the 1981 Tax Reduction Act. We felt at the time, I still feel that that was an excellent piece of legislation. It made total sense in our view. High marginal tax rates were a great burden on this economy in the 70s. And I think the reduction in those tax rates, which took place in the 80s, is one of the reasons why we had the kind of growth rate in the 80s that we've had and created 21 million jobs. In 1982, however, if you think back on that period, after the 81 Act passed, there came an awful lot of discussion in the Congress, most of it from the Democratic side of the aisle, but frankly some of it from the Republicans. One of the great failures, I might say, of supply-side economics is it had a convert in Ronald Reagan, and it had several converts in the cabinet, including Don Regan, who was Secretary of the Treasury. But we really never made much of an impact, frankly, on Capitol Hill. Outside of a handful of people you can mention, most of the members of Congress on both sides of the aisle remain essentially Keynesians in their outlook. And that, by the way, includes most of the Republicans in both the House and Senate. In any case, Congress began to focus on the question of the federal deficit, which was obviously enlarged in the recession of 81-82, a recession which was caused by the chairman and the members of the board of the Federal Reserve overreacted, in our view, to the inflation that Ronald Reagan inherited, really didn't understand the administration's long-term perspective in terms of holding down the rate of government spending. But in any case, the Fed caused the recession. The recession made the deficit, which Reagan inherited, enlarge substantially. The Congress then got very concerned and excited about the need for a deficit reduction program. And in the summer of 1982, the Finance Committee, chaired by Senator Dole of Kansas, began the work on a program of tax increases to be combined with spending reductions to get a handle on this federal deficit. I had developed a very close relationship during this period with Elizabeth Dole, who at the time was the director of the public liaison of the office of the White House. Now, the public liaison office of the White House is the office which is supposed to reach out to various constituencies in the country, the business community, women's groups, farm groups, et cetera, labor groups, all the rest, to try to sell the president's program, the administration's program, to those groups and generate those groups' help in terms of enactment of the program. Early on in the administration, I met with a senior member of the White House who said he had just come from a meeting with a journalist and was asked, he had been in the Nixon administration, and he was asked, what's the difference between the Nixon administration and the Reagan administration? He said, I can tell you with one story. In the Nixon administration, the director of public liaison was Chuck Colson, and in the Reagan administration, it's Elizabeth Dole. Which I think does tell you an awful lot about the two administrations. In any case, Elizabeth had the president's interest foremost in her heart. However, I think at times she also had the interest of the senator from Kansas in her heart, which is not too surprising. Elizabeth, to this day, will say that they don't discuss public policy at home, and I suspect they don't. They probably don't have to. They're probably really pretty much on the same wavelength. In any case, Senator Dole, working with Jim Baker mostly, but also to some extent with me and to some extent with Mike Deaver. Mike Deaver's role in all of this was basically the person who kept the president's schedule and had a great relationship with Nancy Reagan, and that was his entree to policy in the administration. In any case, Jim Baker convinced Mike Deaver that a tax increase was necessary, that a deficit reduction program was necessary in order to get Paul Volcker to agree to begin to increase the rate of growth of the money aggregate so that we could have an end to the recession. Deaver worked on Nancy Reagan, and Nancy Reagan worked on the president, and by about late June of 1982, the president was on board for a tax increase, the theory being that we'd have a tax increase, and for every dollar of tax increases, we'd have $3 of spending reductions. Well, how I come into this picture is that the tax increase that the Finance Committee was formulating was a tax increase essentially on business. It did an awful lot to reduce the depreciation reform, which took place in 1981. It really increased corporate rates fairly substantially. It was a little bit of an increase on individuals, but mostly it was a tax on business. I was called to the White House sometime in the late summer of late June, early July of 1982, and for a meeting in Elizabeth Dole's office. And it turned out that what Elizabeth was interested in is finding someone who could lead a coalition in support of this Senate Finance Committee bill to raise taxes. And she asked me to lead the charge. I must tell you, I have my supply side friends, Paul Craig Roberts, to this day has never forgiven me. To some extent, Jim Miller. And others who are supply-siders have never really forgiven me for what I did, which they regarded as essentially evil. I didn't regard it as evil, but I did regard it as distasteful. But nonetheless, Elizabeth asked us to lead the charge. Well, we discussed it at the American Business Conference. We didn't like it. We didn't think the tax bill itself was very badly drawn. It was not good public policy. But the compelling argument that the administration offered, I think, was correct, which is that there's only one way to get Paul Volcker to loosen the rate of growth of the money aggregates and end the recession, and that was to have a deficit reduction program. And there was no way to get a deficit reduction program through the Congress without a tax increase. And so our executive committee met, our board met. They're very patriotic people who really wanted to make a sacrifice, frankly. And so we went on board, and I led the charge in the business community for that 82 tax increase. And it was a tough fight. We were on board early. The Chamber of Commerce, the United States Chamber of Commerce, opposed that tax increase. Never was on board. Always opposed it. The Business Roundtable wound up supporting it, and there's a little story I'll tell you about that one. The president gave a speech to the country in about August 18th, I think it was, or 19th, 1982, announcing, to try to rally the country in support of this tax bill, which, by the way, passed the Senate pretty easily, but was a major fight in the House. The White House invited a group of us to the White House the next day. And the group was basically CEOs of the Business Roundtable, people like Roger Smith of General Motors, and Bob Beck of Prudential, the AT&T people, the top 25 corporate guys in America. And they sat me next to the president, to the president's right. The president came in and said, I know you all in the Business Roundtable are going to support finally our effort on this tax bill. I just want you to meet Jack Albertine here, who has been leading the fight for this tax bill from the beginning, and he's going to give you your marching orders, which I can tell you went over really well with all these people who are trying to find out who the heck I was. About a year later, I was at the White House with Bob Beck, whom I knew, and I said to Bob, I was a little self-conscious with the chairman of the board of GM sitting to my right, with the president saying, and he said, well, I said to Bob, I suspect a lot of people didn't know who you were. He said, well, the president made clear who you were. So anyway, we supported that thing. And of course, what happened is it passed. Now, the president probably after that, maybe 15 times in meetings I was present, regretted that whole episode, because of course what happened is what you would have expected to happen. The Congress was very happy to pass a tax increase, but those $3 of spending reductions never happened. In fact, Congress increased spending substantially after that. So that was an experience. I think the president felt very strongly about it. Every meeting I was with after that with the president, when tax increases came up, he mentioned that. And I think that made a tremendous impact on him in terms of the fact that he really did get bamboozled by the Congress, and to some extent by Paul Volcker, and to some extent, I think, by the White House staff. We also, as time went on, we got very concerned at the American Business Conference about high, the fact now that we had these new taxes on corporations, and we also had this high corporate tax rates. The kinds of companies that I represented at the American Business Conference, a number of whom on whose boards I now serve, tend to be companies that are high thought content intensive. They're not capital intensive, and therefore they tend to have very high corporate rates. We did a number of studies during this period about the high cost of capital in the United States and high corporate rates and all the rest. And so we were very supportive of the attempt by the Treasury, which started in 1984, to reform the tax code. And that story really is an interesting story as well. The administration was looking around trying to, once it did its 81 tax reduction, it didn't, and then it did the slight take back in 82. It really was looking around in 1980, late 83 and early 84 for a program to provide some vision for what the second Reagan term would look like. And you may recall that in the president's State of the Union in 1984, he announced that he was going to direct the Treasury to do a study to promote greater tax simplicity, fairness, and economic growth, and that the Treasury would report back to the administration, to the White House in December of 1984. Well, we supported that effort. We thought the whole notion of getting rid of all these various exemptions and exclusions in the tax code, and just simply lowering rates would be a dandy idea. And we were we made our views known to Don Regan. We developed a very good relationship, by the way, with Secretary Regan, particularly in '82, because he sort of was where we were. He didn't like the tax increase, but he fought for it. So we made our views known that we thought that this tax reform effort was would be a good effort. The Treasury Department proposed its tax reform in December of 1984, which basically was a wonderful program of absolute rate reductions, the top rate being 25%, and elimination of most exclusions and exemptions. The response was absolute uproar in the business community, and uproar to some extent in the administration. The White House ran away from that proposal, because all the special interest groups in the country came in to oppose it. But then a key thing happened, which was very important with respect to the ultimate passage of the Tax Reform Act, and that is Jim Baker and Don Regan traded jobs. If Don Regan had stayed at Treasury and Jim Baker had stayed at the White House, my view, there would never have been a Tax Reform Act of '86. But for reasons that I think everybody knows, Jim Baker wanted to be a principal. Don Regan wanted to enhance his power. They traded jobs. And that meant that Regan now brought the White House on board for essentially his tax reform proposal. And of course, Jim Baker really at Treasury had nothing to do. Didn't have a lot to do, so we needed a major legislative initiative, and tax reform was that one, so it worked to both of their advantages. They modified the tax reform package a little bit and brought a second one out in February of 1985. Now, there's a story that I think is instructive about sort of the president's attitude about all this. The White House invited a group of CEOs to meet with the president in the cabinet room the day before the State of the Union in 1985. The ostensive purpose of the meeting was to discuss with the president what was good about the first administration and what was bad about the first administration and what could be improved. The real reason, however, was to get a group of CEOs that the president could relate to, that the president really liked, and that would charge him up, essentially, for his State of the Union address. In any case, now, we met with the president that morning at the White House, and the on the table now is the Treasury's proposal, which proposal did a couple of things, one of which is it eliminated the special treatment of capital gains, because all exemptions and exclusions were gone, and now all you had is a reduction, frankly, in the top rate at this point to 25%. So there was no special capital gains exclusion. Well, people went around the table to talk about good things and bad things, that sort of thing. And there's a CEO from a company called Argot, who was one of our ABC guys, Roger Wellington. He and I serve on two boards together. Roger said to the president when it was his turn, he said, "You know, Mr. President," said, the very best thing you did in your first administration was to lower the capital gains rate from 50% to 28%, which was part of the 81 Act. And when he said that, I wonder what the president's going to say to this, since his current proposal sitting there eliminates the capital gains exclusion. And so, because sometimes in meetings the president would respond and sometimes he would not. The president sat up in his chair and said, "That's exactly right." He said, "Every time we have lowered the capital gains rate, we have seen an increase in economic growth, an increase in productivity, an increase in job formation. And every time they have raised the capital gains rate, we have seen a reduction in productivity, a reduction in job formation, and a reduction in economic growth." Well, of course, I just misstated what happened on the rate. The rate actually was lowered from 50% to 20%, and it was raised back to 25% under the Treasury bill. It was pretty obvious that the president had not focused too carefully on what was actually happening with respect to the bill. Let me just summarize again my impression of the Reagan White House and my feelings about the president. It is true, I think, that the president was not on top of all the details. That Treasury story, I think, is a good example of it. I don't think the president really, probably to this day, really understands the details of what was in that Treasury proposal. The other side of it, however, is, in my view, he had a sense of what he wanted where he wanted to take the country. And I never had a meeting with the president which, for example, he ever said anything but we need to reduce government spending, we need to reduce taxes, and we need to improve our national defense. I mean, I think he really did understand where he wanted to take the country. My own view is, and of course this is not, the conventional wisdom is that the 80s were a time of silliness and economic policy, of supply-side economics gone crazy, of too much debt, not prudent economic policy. I think that's all wrong. I think the supply-side economics worked in the 80s quite well. We created 21 million jobs. We turned the country around. I think the president did a wonderful job of reinvigorating entrepreneurship in America. And I think, frankly, I miss him.
Okay.
I went on much too long, sorry.
There's no rehearsal, but some of you who listen to Mr. Ruckheiser also know that one of his panelists strongly recommended Fruit of the Loom as an investment. So.
let me say that I want to make it clear that I never say anything substantive about any board on which I serve.
Okay, Bill Wemple.
Why does it seem to be impossible, or maybe it's just not so, to get a common acceptance of the what seems to be a very simple understanding that the lower tax rates will generate confidence, activity, business, investment, and consequently be beneficial, rather than the political hammering at things like fairness and so on? Is it that the economics is, that's defective, or that it's just too hard to get people to grasp it and support it, do you think?
Question for the out. Can you hear? Do you hear the question? Why is it that it's so difficult to get common understanding that lower tax rates will promote economic growth?
Well, I think there are two points. One, I happen to be, of all things, a Democrat. Not by philosophical conviction, heavens knows, but sort of out of a sense of tribal loyalty. Democrats, unfortunately, there are two problems I find with Democrats. The first is Democrats really believe, like the idea, and believe in government. I mean, Democrats like the idea of a big and growing federal government which has the ability to allocate resources. And they not only like the federal government to allocate resources directly through spending, they also like the idea of regulating the private sector and making the private sector appropriate resources for public purposes as well. So one of the reasons why we have a hard time selling the notion that it is good for long-term prosperity to have low tax rates is that the Democrats don't like the idea of low tax rates. Low tax rates constrains the ability of government to spend resources. And they want the government to spend resources. That's a fact, in my view. Secondly, you know, sometimes when you listen to, I read a piece the other day about someone a lawyer from Catholic University in the Washington Post arguing against term limitations. And his argument was that there's so much expertise in the Congress. Well, there's no expertise in the Congress. There are a lot of people who are knowledgeable, the way lawyers are knowledgeable about issues, but there's not much expertise on anything in the Congress, particularly economics. I mean, when you listen, for example, to the senator, the junior senator from Connecticut, who about a couple weeks ago, was railing about high oil prices because of the fact, was relating high oil prices to oil costs. You know, you don't know whether to laugh or cry, because you say that cost is an issue with respect to price, but costs don't set prices. I mean, it was a big, thick book written in 1776 about how prices get set. So the answer, in my view, is two. It's one is that Democrats like high tax rates, number one, because they want government to be very large. And secondly, there is just monumental incompetence when it comes to understanding economics, particularly on the Democratic side of the aisle, although also, I must say, to some unfortunate extent on the Republican side of the aisle as well.
Next question. Henry Theobar.
This is a follow-up on Bill's question. Well, a few years ago, up at the Harvard Business School reunion, I happened to be lucky enough to be in a small seminar with one of the business school professors, and he referred to himself almost as a paria in the community there, because he happened to be a very strong supporter of Reaganomics and had much the same view as you had. He was almost the only one, he said, in the whole academic community there that had that point of view. Isn't, aside from the point of view of the Democrat mindset, hasn't the almost universal opinion of the academic world, economic world, had a lot to do with this point of view?
Yeah, no, I think it's a point well taken. If you look at much larger issues than simply the makeup of the Congress, I think you're absolutely right. I think the academic community, certainly the economics community, is incredibly liberal. When I was at the University of Virginia, there were four schools in the country that were not the Keynesian schools: University of Chicago, Purdue, UCLA, and UVA. And I must say, we were the most counterculture, right wing of the entire group. So I think that's one thing, no question about it. Most professors of economics are Keynesian and are really interested in redistribution of income, in my view. Secondly, the other element of society which is terribly important is media. I spent a lot of my time, as that New York Times piece indicated, a lot of my time when I was in Washington, and I still spend some of my time with journalists. Most journalists are liberals, and newspapers tend to have an institutional bias towards populism, since they sell a paper one at a time. And I think the media bias on economic policy is just terribly, terribly, terribly significant. For example, I mean, if you turn on the television or read the papers, I mean, it's not even a debate. The conventional wisdom among most media people is that the Reagan economic policy was a ghastly failure, and now in the 90s we've got to do all sorts of things to redress the problems which occurred in the 80s. I mean, it's not even a debate. So I think you're absolutely right. And, of course, those people have been educated by professors of journalism who are also very liberal.
Henry O'Dell.
Yes. Can we have your comments on the development and the significance of the deficit?
Well, my own... I have a perhaps a different point of view on the deficit than is the accepted wisdom. I don't think the deficit is the key issue. It is an issue. It is not unimportant. But to me, it's not the key issue. The key issue is the size and the reach of the federal government. The key issue is who is allocating the nation's resources. Is it the private sector or is it the public sector? You know, in the Soviet Union, during the period when the Soviets were still communists, they did not have a deficit in their budget because they allocate all of the country's resources. So the key question is the reach of the federal government, the state government, and local governments in terms of allocating resources. And I don't think it really does you any good at all to reduce the federal deficit if you're not simultaneously reducing the command over resources exercised by the government. In other words, raising taxes to reduce the deficit, to me, is not a terribly efficacious policy because it does nothing with respect to those resources. It's real simple in my view. You know, it's either the private sector, I think, it's not that the private sector are necessarily smarter and more moral, higher values, it's just simply your money. If you're in the private sector, it's your money. In the public sector, it's not your money. And I think if it's your money, you spend it a little more wisely than if it's somebody else's money. So my view is the question is the size of the federal government. With respect to the deficit, there is no question in my mind that we could reduce the federal deficit over a reasonably short period of time, 4 or 5 years, strictly by being reasonably moderate on the spending side of the federal ledger. This latest episode, with regard to this latest budget nonsense that went on last year, was one of the greatest frauds ever perpetrated on the American people. Well, it's too strong because there's so many frauds perpetrated by the Congress. But if you think the Social Security Trust Fund is a trust fund, if it approximates a real definition of a trust fund, then you think this budget deficit program was reducing the federal budget. I read, going back to your point, I read maybe 1,000 times, literally, or heard 1,000 times, the budget deficit program that this administration pushed being described as a program of tax increases and spending cuts. Well, there were no spending cuts in this proposal. I mean, there wasn't one set of spending reductions in this proposal. Under the budget proposal that they passed, domestic discretionary spending, which is the domestic programs which were appropriated each year, are going to grow at about 9% next year. If you were the CEO of a company X, and you said I've got to get my team in on a Friday night at 5 o'clock. We've got a crisis here in our company. We really need to batten down the hatches. Times are tough. We need to get our budget under control. So I want, this is the team, I want you all to spend the weekend coming up with a plan, and I want that plan on my desk Monday morning to get control over our budget. And then I raised my hand and said, well, sir, what kind of cut do you want? He said, well, just let's let the budget grow at 9% next year. I think all of us would say, well, why don't we go play golf for the weekend? I mean, we can, that's not terribly difficult. So the answer is, I think it's an issue. I don't think it's the major issue. I think it's a phony issue to some considerable extent. We've raised taxes, which inevitably leads to greater resources being allocated by the federal government. You can solve this deficit problem by simply freezing the budget for 1 or 2 years, and that's what we ought to do.
Other questions? Yes.
Before I ask the same question, I'd like to say that it seems to me that you and others who talk in the group ought to distinguish between good expenditure and bad expenditure. And I think the Reagan did that. Defense expenditure was good expenditure. Non-defense expenditure was bad expenditure. And perhaps more distinction ought to be made when we look at these things in those terms. But I've long had a feeling that one thing that you can attribute the so-called failure of Reaganomics to, if there was a failure, is that spending is the stock in trade of the senator and the congressman. It's his rationale for being. It's how he maintains himself in his job. And if he gives that up, he has a problem. Spending is the stock and trade of the congressman and the representative, and he's not going to back away from his ability to build things up in North Dakota and Lawrence Welk. You know, those are little, but they're symptomatic. And everywhere you go in this last bill, you find those sprinkled throughout the appropriation. And they never cease. But in the aggregate, and I'm not talking about the foolish things, the things for which our senator from Minnesota used to award prizes. I'm talking about the substantial things that, that come out of the Congress as their means of staying there.
Well, I think your first point relates to the second point, which is there ought to be a discussion. You don't hear it much, but there ought to be a discussion over what is it that the government ought to be doing. What is the role of the government? My own personal viewpoint is that the government ought to be limited to those things which the private sector, those things that the society as a whole needs and the private sector cannot provide. National defense is one of those. The level of national defense is a matter of debate and discussion, and reasonable people can disagree on that, but it's clearly national defense. But the government is involved in, the federal government is involved in all sorts of things which do add up in the end. That the, in my view, the government doesn't do very well and the private sector can do very well. You know, when President Bush refused to sign the continuing appropriations bill. There were all sorts of pictures in the media and the Washington Post, in other words, about the Washington Monument having been closed. Well, you know, the discussion in my judgment is what is in the world is the government doing running parks anyway? I don't think you've got, I bet if you looked at it, I'm not in that business, but I bet if you got somebody from the business, somebody from Disney World, and they looked at the way the federal government runs the parks, I bet they would argue they could do it a lot better, more efficiently, and provide greater services for the public at a lower cost. So I think you're absolutely right. I think the question ought to be, what is it that the government is doing? What are legitimate but I think you're absolutely right. That ought to be the debate. And second point is no question. I mean, every member. You know, one thing about the Congress that just is amazing to me. When I was a young, I won't say who this was, but I was a young staff person. I took control of a committee budget and decided that it could be cut, and worked up a program to do that, and then was told by the person who was responsible, and not on my watch. And I think that there's a lot of blame. Blame is universal on this one. When if you look at the congressional budget now is about $3 billion. But by the way, in this latest go-round, they don't cut the congressional budget at all. In fact, it increases by this 9%. When the Republicans took over the Senate in 1980, and I had worked in the Senate before that, I think if you look at the rate of growth of staff and spending, it didn't diminish at all. And I think that is an important question. I think members of Congress they like spending money. It's not their money. It's fun to do if it's not your money.
Next question, Paul David.
You know, I must say I don't like the way the Social Security system is set up. We ought to, in my judgment, have an actuarially sound private/government system. So let me put that aside. The trust fund is not really a trust fund. It's et cetera, et cetera. However, if you look at the program as it is set up, The problem is not Social Security. Social Security, in terms of, I don't like the current taxes going to pay current benefits. But if you take that as a given, the program is perfectly sound. In fact, it's got a big surplus. The problem is not in Social Security. Social Security is paying for itself. So I don't think it's fair to attack Social Security, frankly. I think Medicare is out of control. And I think the whole discretionary portion of the budget is absolutely out of control. You know, what I would do, my recommendation to this administration would be, my recommendation to Congress would be to freeze the budget for at least 1 year, cut it by 1 or 2%, or freeze it for at least 1 year. And then I think you could do these programs of reducing the rate of growth of spending, and you get the path moving down in the right direction.
You don't think you're cutting Medicare or the monitor much, but...
Cutting Medicare is a joke. Yeah. But cutting Medicare, in my judgment... the first place, this thing was so bad, you know, this notion that somehow, if you look at the numbers, the proposal was supposed to be $500 billion, $485 billion or some number. Don't hold me to these exact percentages because I've forgotten, but 73% of the cuts, so-called cuts in the rate of growth, occur in the 1993, 94, 95. Now, anybody who believes that we will even know, given the complications of the way the budget process works, you know, it depends on. Let me give you an example. As I say, if you had a business and you said to me, "I've got $1 million budget and I've cut it by $50,000." My natural reaction would be to say, well, you had $1 million budget this year, you've cut it by $50,000, so in 1991 your budget's going to be $950,000. The Congress comes along and says, we've cut the Medicare program by $50,000. So you naturally assume next year is going to be $950,000. Turns out that what they've cut is the current services budget. Current services being the level that some congressional experts believe would have to be appropriated to maintain services at the current level, which, let's say, is an estimate, is $1.2 million for next year. Well, the estimate could be $1.2 million, it could be $1.3 million, it could be $1.1 million. But if the estimate's $1.2 million, but we actually appropriate $1.15 million, we've cut the deficit by $50,000. So that's the first point. First point is, it's not clear to me what in the world baselines they used with respect to all this. Secondly, that if anybody believes that the next Congress is going to somehow be obliged to follow what the last Congress did, believes that the Graham-Rudman proposal would actually have an effect. I mean, not once in 5 years did sequestration ever occur under Graham-Rudman. In the budget process as a whole, in 1990, there were 60 waivers to the Budget Act that were granted. So the notion that somehow we're ever going to get these savings, I think, is silly. And I think you'll find the deficit deteriorates, and I don't think the Medicare program has even been in any way, shape, or form constrained.
I want to be sure we get full benefit of your views on one matter. I think I have a pretty clear understanding of what Jack Albertine thinks, what his economic philosophy is. But I wonder if you'd say just a little bit more about President Reagan's economic thinking. You sketched the broad outlines, but out of the community of people with whom you associated, what is the view, for instance, on the fact that Reagan stopped being Reagan at one point in his economic policy? What is the view that he didn't understand some of the things that Martin Anderson and others spelled out? Did he talk about economic matters with people like you in any detail? Did he ask questions? Was he intellectually curious about economics? These are the questions that we've been trying to probe, and I think in this area, probably more than in any other, it's hard to come by any kind of evidence, but it would be very helpful if you'd say just a little bit more about that.
Well, my impressions always was, I think the president had a very clear economic philosophy, which I have described. I mean, I think the president felt at bottom, number one, that government was too big, too expensive, too incompetent, and too intrusive. Number two, that resources should be allocated by the private sector rather than the government. Number three, I think the president did have a pretty good, and the president used to talk about this quite a bit. He used to say, when people, business people, for example, particularly big business people, were generally pushing to raise taxes and to cut defense spending. And the president would often say, you know, the first responsibility of government is to provide for national defense. And that's what I'm going to do, and I'm not going to weaken, let our national defenses become weakened. So I think he had a very clear, I think he had a pretty clear sense of what the priorities were, at least in his mind, with respect to federal spending. You know, the president, you know, as he's publicly, the president, by the way, is the same privately and publicly. I never, no difference at all. I mean, he publicly talked about, privately a lot, talked a great deal about those famous days in the 40s when he sat around the Brown Derby drinking coffee because the marginal tax rates were 92% and didn't pay anybody to go out and make movies. Because why would you do it at those kinds of rates? If you made five movies or two movies, it really didn't matter a whole bunch. I think he had a very strong, visceral dislike for high marginal tax rates. He understood capital gains, which I refer to quite well. Apparently, I asked Reagan about that question. Apparently, the president, when he was ranching, was instructed by some accountant about the effects of the capital gains exclusion on his own tax rates. So I think he had very clear ideas. Was he intellectually curious? I think the answer is no. Was there a lot of discussions? No. I never heard the president do what I'm doing, for example, you know, holding forth for length. I've never heard the president do that. He just simply had a pretty simple set of ideas, and I never saw anyone say anything to him that caused him to deviate from those. When did he stop being Reagan? I think he stopped being Reagan in 1982 when we did that tax increase. I think that's really the only really major departure from his economic philosophy. And I think he was simply surrounded by his staff on that one. And I think probably felt that there was no other way to prevail on Paul Volcker to reduce the rate of growth, to increase the rate of growth of money aggregates. But I think that's the only deviation, significant deviation from the Reagan policy in the 80s. He was a system, always free trade. I never heard the president ever say anything to anyone that did not project a free trade point of view. So I think the answer is he was consistent in terms of reducing the rate of growth of government spending, in terms of reducing taxes, in terms of reducing the regulatory grip on the economy, free trade, and was pretty comfortable that he had the right positions.
One or two more questions.
Well, how much do you have a plan for the public sector under your plan to care for the aging?
Oh, yeah, no, I think... No, there's no question about it. I think there's no question that...
Well, all you said is defense.
Oh, no, I said that that's very clear, that you have to have...
Well, is care of the aged clear?
Yeah, I think there's no question about it. And care of poor people is clear. I mean, there's no question. There's some people in the society, for example, who are not capable of caring for themselves. There are people who are... They're poor people. There are disadvantaged people. There are handicapped people. And there's no question that... That we need a system of social insurance. The question is, how do you structure that? And in my view, the way to do it would be to have a Social Security system that was actuarially sound and that was augmented by a tax code which gave very substantial tax breaks to people who provided for their own long-term insurance. I think that's the rational way to go about having a social insurance system. To the extent...
Congressman Slaughter's introduced that, and it hasn't gotten off the floor.
No, because the Democrats like the current system, which is really a intergenerational redistribution of income. I don't think that's the best system we could have. Now, if there is no alternative to that, obviously I would support it. But that's a responsibility of government. There's no question that building of roads and infrastructure is a responsibility of government. We don't do that very well. We don't even manage the whole process of the federal budget very well. There ought to be an operations budget, and there ought to be a capital budget, frankly. And then we'd have a more rational understanding of what the actual federal deficit is.
Wilson Newman and then Victor Yunke.
Mr. Albertine, when you mentioned the Joint Committee,
mm-hmm.
it brought back to me many memories. I believe that Senator Flanders was the first head chairman of the Joint Committee when it was organized sometime. Whenever it was, and I can remember delivering reports to him for that. You were chief of staff for the Joint Committee?
Yes.
Which is the organization for the Congress for massaging economic information. The Council of Economic Advisors, up until now, hasn't been mentioned during our discussion this morning. And I guess that is the organization for the White House massaging economic. I think your position as chief of staff for the Joint Committee must have put you into the catbird seat in viewing the enormous impact upon expedient political necessities, irrespective of their beneficial or harmful effect on economies. Would you comment on, we've been talking about economics, mathematics, spending, and so on. We haven't talked much about the compromises that have been made in order to be reelected. Could you address that?
Sure. I'll give you one example that I think is illustrative of what happens with respect to the Congress. In 1980, when I was at the Joint Economic Committee, there was a recession, as you may recall, in the spring of 1980, and so there was an awful lot of discussion about among Democrats about how to end the recession, and so I directed the staff of the Joint Economic Committee to go back and look at every so-called counter-cyclical program, which was enacted by the Congress to have an effect on each recession since World War II. I think at that point there had been 7 recessions. And the question I asked the staff to address was, did any of those counter-cyclical programs actually have a significant effect on the recession that they were designed to end? And the answer was that the staff had looked something like 35 pieces of legislation that were enacted. And the answer was there was not one single piece of legislation that was ever even enacted before the recession ended. The best example of that was in 1970, we had the recession, of course, of 1974-75. And you may recall this. The recession started in September of 74 and ended in at the end of the first quarter of 75. President Ford had called a summit on inflation the very month that we had the recession started, which is what government usually does. It usually is a lie. Any case, in the spring of 1975, that is the second quarter of 1975, when the recession had ended. Of course, we didn't know the recession had ended, but the recession had ended. The Congress decided that it needed to pass a counter-cyclical emergency public works program of $2 billion, and it passed. And President Ford, to his credit, vetoed that piece of legislation, and he made the veto stick. The Congress then came back in the summer of 1976. Now, the recession had been over by this point 15 months, and it was clearly over, and once again passed a counter-cyclical emergency public works spending program to end the recession, which had ended 15 months before. President, to his credit, vetoed that legislation, but this was now 76. It was an election year, the summer of 76, and the Congress overrode his veto. With the votes, for example, of Senator Jim Buckley, one of the most conservative members of the Senate in New York. Well, the Carter administration, and President Carter came to power in January of 1977, they thought this counter-cyclical stuff was so important that they proposed, now you think I'm making this up, but I'm not, because this is true. They proposed in the summer of in the spring of 1977, a $4 billion, and they called it Counter-Cyclical Emergency Public Works Program. Now, and it passed, of course, and overwhelmingly passed, was signed by the president. Now, the punchline is that both programs actually did become counter-cyclical because there was still, I looked this up in 1980, there was still about $1 billion which had not been spent that wound up being spent in the summer of 1980 when we had the recession. So the answer is, that's one of the major problems, that what drives economic policy is not good economics or good economic theory. What drives it is politics.
Victor Yonke.
I sort of lost him in the title. Would it be to the greater advantage of the nation and the business community to emphasize more tax reductions for investment and research development rather than fighting all the time over capital gains, allow a far greater advantage in that respect, especially if it's kept within the United States?
Well, let me make this point about capital gains, number one. I have heard commentators, I can't tell you the number of commentators that I have heard say this effort to try to lower the capital gains rate, increase the exclusion, is a violation of the neutrality of the 1986 Tax Reform Act. Well, the fact is, on equities, now putting only equities on the table, forgetting real estate, timber, and that sort of thing. On equities, capital gain taxation represents double taxation of income. The fact is, if we were really going to encourage savings and investment, we ought to have a zero capital gains tax. That makes investment spending and savings equal to consumption. Because there is double taxation. If a corporation earns money, it pays taxes, and then it has retained earnings. On those retained earnings, share prices presumably rise, and when the shareholder sells it, the shareholder has to pay another tax. And if there's dividends, it's triple taxation on investment income. So that's why I think capital gains reduction is a good idea. It's not the only way to go, no. I think, frankly, just lowering the corporate rate is a good idea. I think research and development tax credits are... I'd support any tax reduction of any kind on anybody in the country, including Social Security tax reductions, because I happen to think that keeping money out of the hands of Congress is a good idea. The more you do it, the better off you are. To be political and pragmatic about it. But I think you're right. I think those are good policy proposals. The problem we have now is we're going totally in the other direction. We've gotten the Democrats now think they've got this soak the rich idea, which they think is politically very popular. And I frankly think in the next Congress we're going to see another tax increase, and I think we're going to see it adverse to savings and investment.
One last brief, very brief question.
Would you say that it's rare and also an excellent thing to have a president in office who has these very definite, unwavering principles that everybody can understand, which Ronald Reagan showed? Isn't that an unusual situation? And isn't it, would you say, a good thing to have from the standpoint of the politics of the country as a whole?
Absolutely. I think the president, I think the greatest attribute that Ronald Reagan had was his sense of understanding where he wanted to take the country and being able to articulate it in extremely understandable ways to the average American. I don't think there's any question about it. I think having vision and having a philosophical anchor is terribly, terribly important. And you're right. It's not a normal thing for presidents to have, in my judgment.
Economics is supposed to be a dismal science. Our speaker this morning has lit it up on whether you've agreed with each or every point. Why, this has been a very lively exchange, and we're very grateful to you.